Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a minute, we'll be talking through all the week's security news with Adam Boileau, and we'll also be hearing in the news segment from Kim Zetter on the votes e-voting kerfuffle, and also Alexa O'Brien on the latest in the Joshua Schulte Vault 7 trial, which is in progress there in the United States. And after all of that, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Dave Cottingham from Airlock Digital. Airlock Digital makes whitelisting software that's actually usable. And until I did this interview, I didn't actually know that their agent does host hardening as well, which is pretty cool. And since we last spoke, they've also popped up in CrowdStrike's App Store thingy, which means a bunch of you CrowdStrike customers will be able to dabble in Airlock Digital's whitelisting tech if that's something you want to do. So yeah, Dave will be talking about a bunch of stuff, including their experience of having Silvio Cesare do a code audit on their agent. It's a great interview, that one, so do stick around for that. But before all of that, of course, it is time for this week's news segment with Adam Boileau. And Adam, ransomware's in the tubes.
Yes, the literal tubes are being ransomwared. In this case, US Department of Homeland Security, CISA, have put out an advisory talking about an attack that happened some time ago in a US like natural gas compression facility where someone ransomwared in, got onto the corporate side of the network, and then pivoted across into the control systems environment, the OT operational tech environment.
Now, hang on. You said a natural gas compression facility. Is that right?
Yeah, but well, a number of natural gas compression facilities.
That doesn't sound like the sort of place where you want ransomware.
No, it really doesn't. And the people who got in there and deployed the ransomware, we don't know exactly which one. They crossed the gap into the OT environment and then dropped ransomware on a number of the Windows machines in the actual control systems environment. And then simultaneously ransomware both sides of the network. Literally ransomware in the tubes.
Insert this is fine meme here, right?
Like, well, it does raise quite a few questions. But obviously, in the ideal world, in a control systems environment like that, there is like an actual air gap. And when those, control systems people really, really love believing in air gaps. And clearly there was some, path between the two environments. And a lot of people say, hey, it's air gap, but hey, we've just got some Citrix. Like, that's the air gap. We have Citrix. That's not exactly how it works.
That's not an air gap.
No. And then they got him. Anyway, the write-up says that they subsequently shut down processing in their natural gas compression set of facilities because when you shut down one, apparently it was limited to one particular site that got ransomware, but of course the pipelines contain actual, gas, so they do interact with each other, and they had to shut down the entire processing operation for a couple of days whilst they dealt with this, and they restored some backups, restored some configs to their PLCs. Everything's totally fine, no problem. But yeah, there are a lot of listeners, I'm sure, who are responsible for this kind of environment. And a concrete example of ransomware jumping the quote air gap unquote is a useful thing to have for your slide decks. And like the response to this has got me a little bit, there's a few bits that I'm not 100% clear about from the reporting that we've got. Like one of the things that they've said is that the attackers had no ability to control the industrial process. And yet at the same time, the same report says that they were dropping ransomware on the HMI, the human machine interfaces that actually render the interface for the operators to look at. And I don't kind of see how you would manage to have, local admin, let's face it, on a Windows box to be able to ransomware it and then not have the ability to then interact with the HMI and control
the
industrial
processes.
Well, I mean,
that's the thing. The word ability is doing a lot of lifting there, right? Does this ransomware manipulate control systems? No. Therefore, they didn't have the ability. Could that be the game they're playing?
Well,
possibly.
I think so. Or maybe there was actually an air gap and the ransomware crossed it, on a USB stick or on something where there wasn't interactive control by the attacker of the machine getting ransomware, and the fact that it triggered at the same time, maybe that was, a prearranged, date time trigger as opposed to a human controlled thing. Or maybe they had some way to move it across and then see some output, like the fact that it got deployed, but didn't have any direct interaction. So, like, there's some ways to thread that needle and kind of still be saying the same thing. But it just, if the attacker's got the ability to run code on the HMI, I feel like probably it's a bit disingenuous to say that they didn't have the ability to alter the industrial process. Why DHS would, kind of come out and say that they didn't, you know, why they would play along with that fiction if they didn't have to, or if there wasn't some other reason, or there wasn't some other aspect of the story that we don't know about. You know, there's something else going on, I guess, is my thinking.
Yeah, well, we'll either get an email or a message based on your comments just then, or we won't. And if we don't. I guess we know what that means. I should mention too, Toll Group here in Australia still having trouble. A whole bunch of their systems still not back online after their January 31 attack. They got a lot of their customers writing out consignment notices with pens on, you know, like manually filling in consignment notices. They've brought some stuff back up, but it's, you know, it's an ongoing situation there. I'm frankly quite impressed that the business is functioning at all, but I think it'll be months before we'll know just how bad it was. So we don't really know yet. I'm just mentioning that. So yeah, 2020 definitely shaping up as the year of big game ransomware. And I don't know what happens from here, to be honest, when we got gas pipelines and logistics companies and just everyone getting owned sideways with dumb stuff. Let's see what 2020 brings. But the other big news this week is the United States Department of Justice dropped a superseding indictment on Huawei. And, you know, it's much of the same stuff that we've seen before, but now we're talking criminal charges instead of lawsuits.
Yeah, the indictment pulls together a bunch of the stories we've heard previously. You know, the thing about Huawei measuring, you know, Verizon's robot arm that presses, you know, mobile phone
Tappy.
Screens.
You love Tappy. You're obsessed with Tappy the robot.
And we've seen some other examples, you know, through the, you know, of Huawei using academic researchers to get access to information. Or there's the guy that was, you know, the Huawei employee that was wandering around a trade show at, you know, in the middle of the night, taking the cover off some competing network vendors' devices, and like taking photos of the circuit boards. And then Huawei said, oh, well, you know, it was after hours. He was on his own time. It wasn't our problem. You know, all of those sort of things all pulled together into one big jumbo indictment, along with, you know, some of the sanction busting stuff of them operating subsidiaries in Iran and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it pulls together all of those threads. Huawei, of course, have said, you know, this is all like years old. We've never really been convicted of anything, and yeah, it's totally fine. But yeah, clearly the US DOJ is, you know, slapping a very big thick pile of paper down on the table and saying, here we go.
Yeah, that's it. It's a indictment Voltron, if you will.
Yes.
I thought you'd like that. Now, votes, of course, spelled, because this is the technology industry, V-O-A-T-Z. Sorry to do that to you, people. But yes, votes. This is a voting app which has been used in West Virginia and Oregon. This is a blockchain-based mobile voting platform. And some researchers at MIT have basically ripped the thing to bits. Votes have said that this research was looking at an old version of their app and that everything's fine and they didn't understand how it works. Now, you know, there's enough uncertainty around this one that I reached out to Kim Zetter, the reporter Kim Zetter, who is, you know, this is a topic that she covers extensively. Like, if you want to read some good stuff on voting system security, like, she is the person you want to follow. So I asked her to give us her rundown on this story, and here's what she had to say.
So the issue with votes is that they don't have a lot of oversight. Unlike voting machine vendors who have to put their systems through federal testing and certification, election apps like this don't have any kind of oversight. I mean, the voting machine vendors don't have much oversight either. But in this case, the voting app makers don't have any oversight. And votes entered this market because of a need to get ballots faster to military and overseas voters. The problem is, of course, is that they have had no independent security research done on the app. They claim that they have. On their website, they had listed five entities that had provided independent audits of their system. But it turns out that, you know, one of those was Komodo, another one was Qualys SSL Labs, and what they were really talking about there were scans, not independent audits. So they don't even seem to understand the terminology in InfoSec of what qualifies as an audit. Another one that they listed was HackerOne, but HackerOne, of course, is a bug bounty program. That's not an independent security audit either. So they haven't been very transparent about the independent audits, but they tout these over and over again to journalists, and journalists are just supposed to, you know, accept this, that they've had some kind of independent security audit. So this audit that the MIT researchers did, or it's actually not an audit, I mean, they reverse engineered it, so it wasn't authorized. You know, it's really the most public assessment that we've had of this system, and that, you know, election officials have who are considering purchasing it. So they reverse engineered the code, and they found a lot of problems with it, primarily that someone could see how a voter was voting, intercept the ballot, or prevent the ballot from being delivered at all in sort of a denial of service attack for that voter, or alter the votes. But the other interesting thing was that, you know, Votes touts its use of blockchain technology, both for transmitting the votes and for storing them. They may be using blockchain for storing those votes, but what the researchers found was they were not really using it for that transmission of votes. And so the votes were just being sent over standard HTTPS. I think that also the issue of the blockchain and their marketing of that raises a lot of questions about, you know, what we can really trust from the company. And again, we need some kind of independent oversight. And what the researchers have done is a good start, but it's not complete. Votes, of course, has responded that they looked at an old version of the app. But this is the version of the app that was being provided to election officials, to Votes customers on the Google Play Store. So, you know, why is there an old version of the app being made available by them to customers if it was not the latest version? They also said something that was a little kludgy, as they said that they had since put out 27 different versions of the app since the version that the researchers looked at. And that's, of course, open to question. I mean, what do they mean by 27? Is that 27 builds? Is it 27 actual versions? What were the changes in those versions, really, if really any substantive changes? And whether any of those changes actually affected the issues that the researchers found is up to question as well. Votes has never indicated whether or not those 27 subsequent versions addressed the problems that the researchers found. So it's sort of beside the point whether or not it's an old version or a new version. So there's a lot of questions. There are more questions raised about Votes and its assertions about the report from the researchers than about the report from the researchers themselves. Their report is pretty solid, and they are transparent and honest about what they did look at and what they weren't able to look at and what the limitations were of their research.
So I guess in 2020, we get to answer the question after the Iowa stuff and now this, you know, what does it look like when we try to handle elections and voting processes on mobile apps and it looks like this and it doesn't look good and we're all doomed?
Yeah, pretty much. Man, this is exactly what you would expect, unfortunately, like a whole bunch of marketing rubbish, a bunch of kind of denial and trying to hide behind, oh, we got it reviewed by, you know, SSL Labs. And yeah, an app that, you know, pretends I'm a blockchain your stuff when really it's just HTTP posting. And the, you know, as Kim says, the report from the MIT researchers is solid, right? I read a lot of mobile app reviews in my day job, and it's a good report, right? It covers up what they did, the limitations of it, and the response from Votes just looks like garbage to me. So I think it's pretty clear to me which side the truth is on in this one.
Yeah, and I want to just thank Kim for sharing that audio with us. Thank you very much for your time on that. Microsoft, meanwhile, is deploying its Election Guard voting software, according to this piece by Catalin Kimpanu from ZDNet. And this is the thing, right? Like, isn't it crazy that here we are in 2020 and we're saying, wow, Microsoft's actually come up with some good voting-related technology, and you're inclined to trust it because it's Microsoft and they know security. How the times change.
This is a funny topsy-turvy world, isn't it? But this is what it should look like. I mean, Microsoft's, you know, really kind of changed its stripes over the years, and, you know, much more embracing of open source, and, you know, the fact that they've got you know, really good cryptography and kind of very clear examples of what they're trying, the problems they're trying to solve with their voting platform. It's such a contrast, right, between this, like, we've got a startup that's probably paid a grad to write a rubbish mobile app versus Microsoft that have spent quite a lot of time thinking about, well, actually, I guess a surprisingly short amount of time. I think they said they developed their voting Election Guard voting platform in something like 9 months, so not a whole bunch. But they've really kind of thought through, you know, all of the previous problems, and not just in the security aspects. There's also the kind of the accessibility parts of it, and how the rest of the verification process works with the you know, paper ballot and that kind of thing. I thought it was particularly interesting, you know, looking at the contrast of, you know, the use of cryptographic techniques so that you can't tell who's voting for what, you know, on the network. Like in the votes app, you can look at the size of the HTTP request going past and probably figure out who someone voted for without having to decrypt anything. Whereas the Microsoft side of thing has, you know, actual robust cryptography, and the fact that they're, you know, out there trialing that, you know, with support from Microsoft is just a really good sign. And I think, you know, this is a much more promising avenue to go down with, you know, Microsoft's experience with handling the scrutiny of their systems and testing and, you know, handling you know, security issues well, not just kind of stonewalling it like votes did. I think this is, you know, this is good on Microsoft, and the contrast is very strong.
Yeah, I mean, we should point out too, Election Guard is like the SDK that they produced that allowed voting machine makers to use, you know, they could use that SDK, right? So that's their approach, which is a very Microsoft sort of approach, focusing on the developers and empowering developers to get what they need done, right? So, you know, maybe that'll spread over into mobile platforms. And of course, you know, there is going to be a need for mobile voting, as, you know, in the future, as Kim mentioned, you know, for like service members deployed overseas, things like that. It's going to solve a lot of problems. It's going to get more people voting, that's good, but obviously we want it to be better than rubbish apps that are like, we've got a bug bounty, so it's been audited, and we Komodo says it's good, you know, like, oh god.
I didn't know that detail until Kim pointed out. That's just so funny.
Yes,
I mean, deeply painful, you know, and you know,
is it funny or is it tragedy or is it comedy plus time? You know, tragedy plus time, there hasn't been much time. No, it's just funny. It's just comedy.
No, it's, I don't know.
Now, speaking of funny stuff, the Joshua Schulte trial is continuing. There's two funny things that have happened. I mean, I think today Schulte has pushed for a mistrial over something like they weren't provided with some information that could have been exculpatory or something along those lines. I doubt that'll get up. Meanwhile, they're trying to call Mike Pompeo as a witness in the Vault 7 trial. And, you know, there's all this stuff coming out about the toxic workplace at this particular area of the CIA where they were developing, you know, all of these exploits and whatnot. It's just a crazy trial. But look, one really interesting thing has come out of this, which is last week a witness, and they give all of the witnesses pseudonyms, this witness Michael, there's this other person in the mix now that the defense is trying to set up as like possibly an alternative source of the leaks, right? So they're trying to establish some doubt in the court's mind as to whether or not Joshua Schulte was actually the leaker, because it turns out on the day of the theft, this guy was sitting around taking screen caps of like disappearing logs and stuff, but he never told anyone. And he says he took the screen caps because it was sus. And then when the FBI interviewed him, he like clammed up and got a lawyer, and now he's on administrative leave. Anyway, Alexa O'Brien is you know, paying a lot of attention to the Schulte trial. But I asked her to tell me about this mysterious person, Michael, and how Michael fits into the Vault 7 trial. And here's what she had to say.
Last week, a ex-CIA co-worker of Schulte testified, and his testimony sort of left you with the sense that you had the hair sort of standing up on the back of your neck. First thing is that he was cooperating with investigators until the FBI discovered a screenshot that he had taken on April 20th, 2016, which is the date of the alleged theft, according to the U.S. government's theory. And he was apparently on the network taking screenshots of stuff that was going on that he testified he considered to be suspicious. But when investigators started to ask him a lot of questions, he got a lawyer. So he's on administrative leave with the CIA. So the spanner in the works right now with regards to his testimony, because he hasn't even finished his cross-examination or redirect, because the court said that the defense, although they had this information about this guy named Michael, this co-worker, apparently the U.S. did not provide Schulte with notice that he was actually a sysadmin too. So anyway, his cross and his redirect have been postponed. And right now, essentially, you know, when you're thinking about a case where, and there's tons of charges, so we have to like remember there are tons of charges here. And, you know, there's also the transmission of national defense information while he's in pretrial confinement. But in terms of the original WikiLeaks April 20 theft charges, essentially what the defense is doing is laying the ground for doubt. And so, you know, it's interesting. We'll see what happens.
So there you go. It's every bit as bonkers as we were hoping for, to be honest.
It doesn't sound like a great place to work, to be honest.
It is a crazy old world. And now, staying with people who got in trouble for taking stuff off networks that they shouldn't have, Reality Winner is seeking clemency over her leaking of documents to The Intercept.
Yeah, I mean, certainly by comparison to some of the other leakers we've seen, she does seem a lot more sympathetic. Yes. And she's the one that's in the clink because her case was a bit more straightforward, I suppose. So, I mean, on that regard, you can kind of see the point. I don't know whether she's going to get anywhere with it, but, you know.
Yeah.
How complicated this process is for her to, you know, to actually get any clemency.
Look, I think she was sentenced as a deterrent to other people thinking about doing the same thing. So I really think that's why she got 6 years ish. I think that was about the length of her sentence. So I don't know. I mean, has she paid that price? Is her spending, you know, a few years in prison now, you know, is that sufficient deterrence? And I'd say probably, yeah, it is. But obviously that's, you know, it's not up to us, right? But I mean, you know, you'd think it wouldn't be the end of the world to cut her some slack, right?
No, she does seem the least worst of the, you know, the people that we would otherwise be talking about getting thrown in jail for this kind of stuff, you know, compared with, you know, people who are hoarding stuff for years and making bad choices a la, you know, Hal Martin, etc.
Yeah, that's right. Now, good news story here. Ring is going to enable 2FA for all user accounts after, you know, a recent run of bad stories of people doing cred stuffing attacks against Ring security cameras. I mean, you know, we've been advocating for this on the show, so obviously we're going to think it's good news.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it is good news, and it's important, I guess, for the other, you know, vendors of IoT tech to look at this and go, do we really want to have to go through all the drama to, you know, have to then make the choice to enroll all of our users in 2FA, you know, 2 years from now, or can we just skip straight to that part, save ourselves a bit of grief, you know, apart from the, you know, obviously the challenges of actually enrolling the users and managing it all, but, you know, versus having a PR nightmare. You know, it seems like this should be a learning example for the others.
Yeah, and Google apparently did the same thing for Nest users last week. So I think it was Motherboard, wasn't it, who did the first flurry of coverage on this? Look, forgive me if I got that wrong, but whoever the journo was who broke this, congratulations, because we've seen some real-world change here. This one's funny from CyberScoop. They are reporting that an Israeli court has found Facebook must unblock NSO group employees' accounts, right? So they can't just kick them off the internet. So there you go. They're going to get their Facebook groups back.
I mean, it will be interesting to see what Facebook does about this, because if I was Facebook, I'd be kind of inclined to say, well, you know, make us, you know, how much business we really have in Israel. Like, maybe we should just burn it all down. I don't know. But no, maybe they will give them their profiles back. Maybe their profiles will suffer some manner of horrible accident and be accidentally deleted. I don't know. And there's nothing to restore. Whoopsie.
You never what happens? Know. But everything, yeah, accidentally really, set to public.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, if you're gonna piss in Facebook's patch in the same way that NSO Group has, like, I don't know that it's unreasonable for Facebook to, you know, give you a little bit of your own medicine.
Yeah, I think that's true. Honestly, though, if they like just kick ban me from Facebook, I don't think that I would sue to get it back. Like, no,
thanks very much. You've you know, now I know how to get my account deleted, because that's really hard, right?
The United States has burned a bunch more North Korean malware. This is Cyber Command, but working with the FBI and I think Caesar as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it looks like it. Caesar and DHS. Burning up a whole bunch of North Korean toys. They've dumped, you know, some rats and droppers and various other, you know, bits of tooling from North Korea, and, you know, kind of positively attributed it to the North Koreans, which is, you know, it's a development that we've kind of seen coming, but now we're getting to the point where it's, you know, straight up, you know, US Cybercom tweeting, hey, this is some North Korean malware that we've just uploaded the virus title for you. Like, that's quite a development from, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. So yeah, good to see. And, you know, if you've got a few IOCs to go run across your network, look for some Norks, then yeah, you might find something.
Hamas has been busy. The organization has been catfishing Israeli soldiers on social media, apparently with some success, but that campaign, Israel says, has been shut down. And a Hamas-linked group has also been going after Fatah targets, you know, their political rivals. So, yeah, busy old couple of weeks for Hamas.
Yes, the Gaza cyber gang clearly earning their keep at the moment. You know, I guess you would expect this. I mean, you know, they've been working against the IDF, you know, with all sorts of tricks and Trojans and catfishing, you know, on and off for years. So, yeah, the fact that they're still doing that, you know, clearly it's working for them. But, yeah, going after their political rivals, I guess also kind of topical and, you know, very much with the times.
Iranian hackers, meanwhile, have been going after like all of these Pulse Secure, Fortinet, Palo Alto Networks and Citrix bugs, right? Like those delicious border device bugs. But are these state-sponsored attacks here, or are they just criminals who happen to be located in Iran?
The reporting seems to suggest that not only is it state-sponsored, it's that all also of the otherwise previously distinct state-sponsored groups have all been piling on because it's such a bonanza of shell time, and they've all been told to, you know, like, let's make some hay while the sun's shining.
So are these boxes like running out of memory? Because well, they're holding that many open connections, you know.
But no, it's interesting that we are seeing a bunch of groups that, you know, otherwise operate pretty independently, all going after the same bunch of things. And it may just be that these bugs are so good that everybody wants to use them. And I think that probably does make sense. But they are exactly the bugs that you want when you're sick of phishing people and you want to get some actual technical shells. So perhaps it's just coincidence. But I think the more interesting news article would be Iran isn't using, you know, remote access bugs, you know, in vendor remote access products.
What's amazing to me, though, is like even in years past, right, you'd see bugs like this pop up and then there wouldn't be much exploitation. I mean, you might hear of it here and there. I remember in 2014 when Alec did that talk at RuxCon about, you know, owning Cisco ASA, and like you didn't really see much come out of it. I mean, if he dropped the same talk today, you know, half the world's APT crews and ransomware crews would be all up in those Ciscos the next day.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of show the sort of ebb and flows of what's fashionable and how you own people. You know, we went through everything was always a Word doc delivered, you know, via email with macros in it. Now everything was a Flash exploit or, you know, IE browser bug or something. And now we're kind of heading back towards server exploitation. And this kind of network edge security stuff has been so neglected for so long that, yeah I mean, 10 years ago, or whatever it was, 6-7 years ago, ASA bugs like that, no one needed them. I mean, they're fun and we use them.
Yeah, but why bother when you can just like email someone a link to a Flash with, and you know,
exactly. And now that the, you know, the endpoint's getting harder again, and we've got, you know, people actually, you know, sandboxing all their email coming in and doing all that analysis, like it is getting harder to land a fish for code exec, right? And 2FA is making it harder to land, you know, fish for cred, and people are looking back to other techniques. And these bugs are just exactly what you want, you know, remote access tech, pre-auth remotes, good.
That's right. Now this next one, more bad news for Avast. They've already divested from their data share group. We reported on that. Joseph Cox is now reporting for Motherboard that a data protection authority is investigating them over this stuff. And it's just like, it just keeps getting worse and worse for Avast. How did they think this was a good idea?
I don't know. I guess they didn't think it was a good idea and they decided they were going to do it anyway. And now they're backpedaling pretty quick, which is, you know, to their credit, at least they decided to backpedal early rather than dragging this out and pretending. But yeah, the Czech government's data protection authority is going to go and smack them upside the head with the GDPR, and I mean, Avast's already, you know, lost a whole bunch of money in this process. I suspect that they're going to see a bunch more out the door.
Brian Krebs reporting on a novel new scam. I like this one.
This is good, yeah. So some people have been getting emails threatening their Google ad revenue. The scammers in question, or the extortionists in question, are saying we're going to flood your ads with fraudulent clicks, thus triggering Google's fraudulent click protection to turn off all your advertising revenue for a month or whatever, and you better pay us so that we don't click on your ads. Which, yeah, it's kind of novel. Good plan. Probably works.
But what I love about this one, right, and why I think this is interesting, more interesting than it first appears, is it is people threatening to turn anti-abuse technology into a weapon, right? So it is really weaponizing anti-abuse. And that's something that I think the big tech platforms are going to see a lot more of in coming years.
Yeah, it's a good example of, you know, using the kind of hacker approach to things to, you know, just take a system as a set of levers that you can pull and then pull them to your own benefit without really caring what those levers were for in the first place. You know, much like we would use, you know, an IDS system, like, you know, sets off alarms or something. Well, you can just trigger all of the alarms and then the, you know, the poor SIEM processing pipeline is going to be busy for a month whilst you go and do the bad thing. And you don't care
I still
about
remember
detected,
when so. Snot came out.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Was, yeah, the one that you just throw at it would trigger absolutely every alarm and then you could do your thing.
Exactly right. And anytime we see a control like that where, okay, we're going to get detected, can we then use that detection to our advantage? And this is the same thing, like whether it's a fraud control or a blocking or a, you know, and we see people using it maliciously on YouTube with the copyright strikes stuff, you know, where people will file fake ones.
Abuse reporting on Twitter as well, where after there's a certain number of reports, I think some automation kicks in.
Yeah, so I mean, all of those things are, you know, kind of ripe for being abused by attackers who are, you know, looking for, especially when it's denial of service, when you're just trying to shut a thing down. And I mean, at the kind of scale that some of these platforms operate, you know, advertising and Twitter and whatever else, but they do end up just automating it. And, you know, anyone who's dealt with YouTube's you know, automated abuse system knows that it's just such a nightmare trying to get hold of an actual person to make, you know, actual common sense choices rather than, you know, ML and algorithms.
Yeah, I've helped a couple of people get their Instagram accounts back before, and it's just, holy God. This next one comes to us via the Daily Swig, Port Swiggers news service. An Ohio man has been arrested for running a Bitcoin Tumblr. What I think is interesting here is the headline they've put on this, which is Ohio man arrested over darknet Bitcoin laundering operation, right? So one man's one man's Bitcoin Tumblr is another man's darknet Bitcoin laundering operation. And I think that's something that we've said on the show before, which is like, you know, you see some crypto people complaining that Tumblr operators are being charged with money laundering, but like that's what a Tumblr is in effect, exactly. Right? So we're seeing, yeah, running a Tumblr is becoming risky.
Yeah, this guy, I mean, for a one-man operation, like he tumbled something like $300 million worth of Bitcoins over a few years operating. Like that's a pretty reasonable scale. Like if you were doing that through, you know, laundries or, you know, Turkish carpet shops or whatever, right, that would take a lot of carpets to launder $300 million. So, you know, in that respect, I guess it is a money laundering operation.
IOTA, meanwhile, having a bad time. They shut down their entire network. I mean, look, I feel like this is the year where the problems involved in cryptocurrency, the security problems involved in cryptocurrency are sort of understood now, right? Like people are kind of a little bit more cautious than they used to be. This is another great example of said problems.
Yeah, this was the IOTA cryptocurrency had their own wallet implementation and that had some kind of bug in it. I don't know what the specifics were, but a whole bunch of high value accounts were targeted all at once and they ended up turning off the entire network. The IOTA network has some kind of like centralized
Validation service.
Well, they're trying to solve the
problem. Isn't the whole point of cryptocurrency to get away from that sort of thing?
I know, but we can disrupt the decentralized cryptocurrency market by having a centralized financial apparatus.
Sounds like a good idea.
I know, right? Imagine that. Then you can have some kind of regulatory control and oversight and anti-money laundering controls. And wow, that almost, I mean, I wonder if there's prior art.
I just remember seeing someone saying like, you know, cryptocurrencies have just been a crash course for computer people on why financial regulations exist, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like just proving them all very quickly in a few years. Another one from Krebs now and Liberty Reserve, which was of course, you know, pre-blockchain shady money transferring. they got shut down around, I think around 2013, but people who had like money with them could basically register with the government and say, hey, can you give me my money back? And it wasn't crime money. Please give me my money back. And so Brian registered as like a Liberty Reserve user with the IRS and he got a call the other day. So apparently the US government has managed to recover some money and they're going to start giving it to deposit holders. And it'll be really funny if someone comes forward and their account is actually connected to crime stuff. I wonder if we'll see an indictment because someone is just dumb enough to come and get their crime box, you know?
Oh, dear. And it's so funny because, right, in the blockchain version of this story, do you really think anyone's going to show up from the IRS trying to give you money back 10 years later because, you know, the blockchain won't work anymore and the money can't, is locked up behind private keys I don't have? At least with this operation, being that it predated blockchain, you've got some chance, perhaps, of getting your, you know, your non-crime money. I'm assuming Brian had at least a couple of non-crime dollars in there or something that he's trying to claim. Yeah, the fact that you're going to get anything back is just amazing. Like, it's a lovely story.
It is. It is a nice story too, where he's talking to the, you know, the IRS guy and he's like, yeah, by the way, I'm a reporter. You know, you sort of read between the lines.
You can just see the IRS guy rubbing his temples in the call center.
Pretty much. We've got a nice feature here from Andy Greenberg over at Wired, looking at what Signal is doing in terms of development after it was given $50 million from Brian Acton, who was one of the co-founders of WhatsApp. It's just a nice rundown on, you know, the issues involved in messaging security and functionality and features versus security and whatnot. But the goal really for them seems to be to make something that everyone can use, which is a worthy goal.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, anyone who uses Signal will have seen the flurry of new features lately, you know, with disappearing messages and stickers and all sorts of things. That
they removed the crash every 5 minutes feature, which some people are missing, nice, you know.
But no, I mean, it's good to see, you know, a bit of the backstory there, because I mean, Signal is such a widely used app amongst our circle, but getting it out into the wider world is a really useful thing. And, you know, the amount of distrust people have in Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp, you know, the fact that people are looking for an alternative, you know, a good one rather than a rubbish one, is a nice thing to have. And obviously, you know, having $50 million show up from someone who's had a bunch of experience building this out with WhatsApp and had a bunch of experience scaling in the way that WhatsApp did before Facebook acquired it, you know, I think it's really good for that, you know, for those people. And I, you know, I kind of hope it brings, you know, some, you know, ease as well to, you know, Moxie, because it was a pretty small crew, the original Signal team, like three or four people or something. And I imagine that was a pretty stressful kind of operation, right? I mean, you got a lot of people relying on you there. And so, yeah, hopefully this brings a little bit of ease, makes things a bit smoother, you know, makes life a bit more predictable for them as well.
Yep, indeed, indeed. We've got another feature actually from Andy at Wired. He's been busy this week. Just really looking at the issue of firmware security and pointing out that, you know, most peripherals are just rubbish junk and don't sign their firmware, and it's going to bite us on the ass at some point. And I think, you know, although this isn't news, it's probably something that we could do to remember.
Yeah, I think so. And this is actually, the write-up is largely about some research from Eclipsium, who we talked about, I think, last week or the week before, with some of their research into DMA attacks. This is them looking at, you know, all of the equipment that's inside your PC, all the embedded processors and stuff that have firmware that isn't signed, has some way of loading code on them. And, you know, it's not a new problem, but it is, as you say, a thing that we do need to keep in mind. Like, modern computers are networks of devices, and once you've got a shell as an attacker on one of them, persisting on one of those embedded systems rather than on the main OS is a good avenue to go down. And we you know, we've seen NSA and CIA doing it in the various leaks from there. We know other people have been doing it as well. It's worthwhile to remember. And, you know, people who've done work in trying to do assurance of firmware and embedded software, like I know the Google team has spent a lot of time trying to validate the integrity of firmware on their, you know, on their devices. You know, it's a really hard thing to get right, and we do have to keep the pressure up on, you know, the supply chain and on the vendors, you know, to think about this stuff and to not cock it all up. Because, you know, maybe you have secure, you know, primary OS, primary CPU, but, you know, network card and all the other things, if they get you owned, then, you know, doesn't really matter to an attacker which way they do it.
This next one is going to be music to the ears of so many listeners. Yubico is like a minor sponsor here at Risky Biz. And every time I announce that I'm going to be interviewing someone from Yubico, I get a flurry of tweets and emails that basically say, when SSH support? OpenSSH has added support for FIDO and UTF security keys.
Yeah, I saw the tweet from Damian Miller coming out about this, you know, the current 8.2 release of OpenSSH, and yeah, adding native support for U2F and FIDO style authentication tokens into SSH is just a great thing. And obviously, you've been able to kind of bolt it in through other mechanisms,
kinda,
but it's just, you know, having it in mainline SSH integrated nicely, so you'll be able to say, like, I require push, you know, proof of presence from a remote hardware security device, like in the SSHD config. Like, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, SSH is, you know, so much stuff runs on OpenSSH. Like, it's probably one of the best engineered bits of software on the internet.
Well, and one of the most important too. I mean, admins the entire planet, right?
Well, exactly. That's the kind of corollary to that, is it's also super, super important. And it's a lovely code base. So, I mean, obviously I've spent some time inside it over the years. It's just a great code base, and, you know, it's good to see them adding new features like this in a control way, but also ripping stuff out. That was one of the other things that was in Damien's tweet, that they are starting the process of ripping out all of the SHA-1 dependent crypto from OpenSSH. And that is going to mean SSH RSA keys being deprecated, and that's going to break a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, we're kind of lucky that it's going to take 5-10 years for modern OpenSSH to trickle down into all of the systems that use it through the distributions or whatever. But it is just kind of nice to see, you know, adding new features and also ripping out the old garbage.
Yep. Yep. Just going to mention this one quickly, and we're sort of on the home stretch here. A Windows 10 update. They had a bit of trouble with one of their updates, I think, depending on how it was deployed, but it sort of nuked user profiles because it created some temporary thing, like moves things into a temporary and didn't clean it up right or whatever. Yeah, so that's been a bit of drama and kind of rare these days to see those sorts of problems. We got another one here from Dan Gooden at Ars, just about a bit of Android malware that actually persisted after people reset their phones to like factory settings, because apparently that factory reset didn't remove a couple of folders or something. And it's just like, it's just an interesting piece on a bit of tricky malware. What else have we got? Google has removed 500 plus malicious Chrome extensions from the web store. And that was, I think they worked with Duo Security on that. So that was pretty cool. It was just adware crap. But, you know, the great project of trying to clean up Google's app stores and extension stores continues. Then this headline is like, what the hell are we even doing? When it turns out that 50%, according to the FBI, 50% of cybercrime losses in 2019 came from business email compromise.
Which, I mean, on the one hand is pretty sobering when you put everything else, all the breaches and everything else, you know, that goes on into context like that. It's like, well, maybe we should just secure people's email a little better. On the other hand, so much, you know, of the cybers happens that doesn't have a financial aspect or isn't reported or isn't discovered. That these numbers are just kind of like so far from reality that I don't know that it matters anyway. But, I mean, I think we can all agree that business email compromise does get people owned and does get money stolen. But I mean, there's just so much other stuff going on that we don't see.
Now, we got a wonderful, wonderful skateboarding dog this week, Adam. And a couple of listeners have put this one in front of me and saying, my God, wasn't Adam saying something, you know, along these lines last week? And you were. But please walk us through this wonderful skateboarding dog.
Oh, dear, dear. Someone on Twitter posted about a bug where you couldn't install and run the Windows Docker at the same time as you were running some, like, Razer gaming mouse control panel. And moral story is, don't install Razer anything on anything you care about because local privilege is everywhere. Anyway, side the point. And they wouldn't run at the same time. And the reason they wouldn't run this at the same time is because both of them wanted to only run one instance of themselves. And so they created, like, a global mutex so that they could detect if another instance of the application was running. And they did so by making a mutex with the GUID of their, like, you know, assembly that was running it. And yes, they both copied and pasted a bad piece of example code of how to get your own GUID from Stack Exchange. And as a result, they were getting the GUID of the, like, type, the object type, rather than their own instance. And yes, as a result, you couldn't run these two at the same time. And it turns out actually they weren't the only examples of people who had copy-pasted this exact piece of garbage code from Stack Exchange into their product and shipped it. So yes.
What's wonderful is this bit of code popped up, like this one line popped up in answer to a question that was asked on Stack Exchange in like 2009.
Stack Exchange does have so much to answer
and
for.
And they can't edit it. Because it was accepted, so it's still there.
Oh, it's so funny. But yeah, I mean, it just goes to show, like, the Stack Exchange, you know, software supply chain is very, very real. And I do think if you, you know, if you went around and just figured out, like, what are the top 10 programming things people are going to Google, and just, like, Stack Exchanged up bad answers, you know, plausible, workable, but broken bad answers, and AstroTurfed up some votes, man, you could get some good bugs into the supply chain.
You sure could. And yeah, look, it's another Everything is Ruined edition of the show this week. It's been a little
every
bit-
week.
Yeah, every it's week. Been a little bit depressing the last couple of weeks, I got to say. It's like just...
because everything's
Well, it's just, it's almost like you're embarrassed reading the news, you know? You just, it's I mean, embarrassing.
I mean, ours is not an engineering discipline. Like, it's clearly arts and craft and we're terrible at it. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little bit embarrassing. It's a little bit funny. It's a little bit tragic. I mean, you know.
Yeah. It does feel like we're buying our democracy-related technology off Etsy a little bit. I think you're right. It's got that vibe. Paper mache.
Macrame.
Mate, that is it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. I am taking a break for a couple of weeks, so I will next be speaking to you in 3 weeks from now, my friend.
Sure, going to be a lot of things that are going to go wrong between now and then, and I look forward to them all.
So yes, please brace for the incoming 5-hour episode in a few weeks. Yeah.
Going to need a bigger SD card.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. And yeah, as I just mentioned, I'm taking a break for a couple of weeks. I timed that break to coincide with RSA. Because a lot of our listeners are going to be too busy there to really listen to the podcast anyway. So yeah, 2 weeks off, time away with the family, that sort of thing. I will be pushing a Soapbox edition tomorrow from Attack IQ that looks really focuses on MITRE ATT&CK. And then I am logging off for a bit. And I will be back with another show. The next edition after that one will be on Wednesday, the 11th of March. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dave Cottingham of Airlock Digital. And I'm really stoked to have these guys on as a sponsor this year. They are a small, unfunded Australian startup that is actually kicking all sorts of ass. They were former practitioners who realized someone needed to make whitelisting software that was usable. So they built their software, ran it up the flagpole, and boom, it turns out a lot of people really like what they've done. They got plenty of salutes. So if you're whitelist curious, you can check them out at airlockdigital.com, or if you're a CrowdStrike customer, you can get them through the CrowdStrike App Store thingy. Anyway, Dave Cottingham is a co-founder at Airlock Digital, and he joined me for this interview. We spoke about the host hardening they're doing to Windows machines, various hardening settings that correspond to MITRE ATT&CK too, which is nice. And we spoke about how ransomware has been a real gift to companies playing in the whitelisting game. But I started off by asking him about something else they did. They did something that most security companies just don't do. They got a code audit done, and they used Silvio Cesare to do that. And after sweating on the looming report, it landed, and it actually came up okay. There were a few issues, but no showstoppers. Here's Dave.
The reason we went out to commission an audit was just to demonstrate a bit of trust to our customers. You know, we are coming from a security background. You know, we really need to make sure that our agent is robust. The last thing that we want to see is some sort of critical vulnerability that an attacker used against our product to get into a customer network. And we were also pretty confident of the actual code base itself in terms of how we operate as an agent. So Microsoft actually classifies our agent as just being a file system filter driver. We're not actually even an AV product on the system. And that's because since we're just doing application whitelisting, all we really need to do is check and hash files that are actually loading on the system. So we can keep our attack surface really, really small. We're not having to do any sort of sandboxing or behavioral analysis of the files. We just care about, you know, is it validly signed and what's the hash value of it? And having such a strictly defined model allows us to have a really small attack surface. But working with Silvio doing the code review was absolutely fantastic. You know, the results sort of exceeded our expectations, and it was a really interesting process for us, having someone else, you know, actually go through the code base and provide us meaningful feedback on that.
I mean, I guess that's the thing, right? You can actually throw software like this at a guy like Silvio and say, find bug, make suggestions, right? Find bugs, yes. Make suggestions. But, you know, try doing that with any fully featured AV. You know, he's going to be working on that for the next 50 years.
Yeah, definitely, right? Definitely. And it's mind-boggling the amount of things that AV tends to have to do on the system in order to look at all aspects of a file. And really what they're trying to do is look at different behaviors of a software as it loads. I guess, yeah, we're in a very lucky position, the fact that we just have to check such a small amount of files to get such a good security result, because we're caring about such little attributes.
Yeah, keeping it simple, right? And so I understand, you know, you're seeing a lot of success right now among customers who are scared of ransomware, which makes an awful lot of sense.
Yes, definitely. So customers are coming to us generally post-breach, unfortunately, just because they've realized that.
Had any calls from Toll Holdings lately?
Not yet, but it might reach out. I think application whitelisting is so effective with ransomware because, as you've talked about on many past episodes of the show, you know, there's this increasing model where attackers will, you know, breach an organization, gain a foothold across the entire network first. And that's something that the attackers actually have to be really good at doing software deployment across an organization, because they want to hit you all at once across all of your,
I mean, it's almost like shadow admin. And I was thinking, a thought occurred to me that it's almost like proves the point that the Okta guy made the other week, which is that, like, you don't need to run AD anymore. You can administer, endpoints without Active Directory, and ransomware crews have proved that. But no, I get your point. I mean, you're going to be able to stop those binaries from spinning up on those hosts, right? Like straight up.
Exactly. A lot of people come to us and say, well, what about fileless malware or, you know, attackers staying off disk? And I guess it's that, yes, true, they can do that. However, you're increasing the bar massively of what the attackers have to do in order to gain a foothold across a significant portion of your network.
Yeah, it means the completely lazy way won't work, right?
Oh, exactly. And, you know, they really need to skill up, you know, in order to be successful. And also, if an attacker throughout that tool chain does drop something to disk at some point, then you've got a pretty good chance of actually doing detection on that. And it was one of the reasons that I guess ASD now, interestingly, in the last few months has told organizations to start doing maturity level 3 of application whitelisting deployments, which is basically you now not only need to do application whitelisting, but you also need to prevent application whitelisting bypasses as well, which actually stops the attackers, you know, doing those fileless malware attacks, because, you know, we're seeing a lot of attackers, particularly, you know, nation state groups, actually go straight to assuming that a lot of organizations are running application whitelisting, which is a good news story, you know, because it means that people are getting better out there. But yeah, it's sort of the bar keeps going up and up and up.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, how do you, you know, when we say fileless, that can mean anything, right? But I guess, you know, what do you do about hijacked processes and stuff like that? I mean, isn't it, you know, that's sort of outside of your wheelhouse, right? That's not something that you can do anything about.
Well, we actually can. Interestingly, we've got a big part of the product, which is blacklisting, which basically what we do is we deploy basically rule sets out there onto the customer endpoints that harden the operating system. So we're actually taking away features of the OS that allow attackers to arbitrarily load code into memory. So things like controlling how, you know, WMI can be called, controlling executables like MS build, even things in Windows 10, like the latest builds of Windows 10 include a SSH client, right? That's signed by Microsoft.
And into the bin. Actually... into the bin. Yeah, yeah. So is that something that you're doing now? You're actually doing host harping?
Yeah. Yeah,
is that new? Because, like, I don't remember you telling me about that previously.
Yeah, in a... About 12 months ago, we implemented that in the product. And we're actually, yeah, not only doing whitelisting, but hardening the system to prevent people getting around whitelisting, you know, which is really big for us.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. And, I mean, the concern with, like, starting to play around with the way Windows does WMI, you know, the concern is always that you're going to break it. And has that been a problem?
Well, when you just deploy the rule set out there, what we normally see is the customer suddenly finds out about all these strange applications that are making WMI queries on their network.
and a lot of them, they're probably like, well, we don't remember actually rolling that out.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, in some cases, unfortunately. But what we can do is then we basically look at, we go through a process with the customer to look at whether that process is actually legitimately doing those queries, whether they expect the software to be there. And if it is, then we can allow that particular application to use WMI, but basically block everything else from actually calling that executable. So if an attacker comes along and tries to just straight up use WMI, it won't work.
It's funny, right? Because this sounds in approach pretty similar to what CMD is doing on Linux, in that, you know, it's just an additional control plane like plonked over the top, which can block certain actions. I mean, that seems to be the idea.
Yeah, definitely. And I think hardening is going to become a bigger thing in the space over the coming years.
That's interesting you say that, man. That's very interesting, because I can't really think, and I'm sure they exist, but I can't really think of anyone out there who's doing that, like, you know, like a Windows hardening agent. Makes a lot of sense, because you flip a bunch of stuff off that you don't need and just allow what you do. I mean, that's gonna get you a pretty good result.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you just did hardening without any other security control, you're reducing the options of an attacker massively, and taking away a lot of the things that they can do. And especially as the features are just getting so much more rich, you know, inbuilt in the base operating system as time goes on. So it seems like compared to where we were, you know, in the Windows 7 days, as much as Windows 10 is a much better, more secure, robust platform, it has a lot of other technologies, it also inherently has a lot of other features built into it that we don't need third-party tools for anymore. So we almost need to go and shut them off. And unfortunately, a lot of the features aren't also designed in a way that you can go into group policy and say, hey, I don't want that SSH client in Windows, things like that. They're just binaries on disk that you need to control how they behave, and you can't do it with some of the inbuilt tooling. So it's, you know, and now that PowerShell is still really heavily used by attackers, I know a lot of security Twitter has sort of said that PowerShell's dead, no one's using it anymore, but we're still seeing it a huge amount in targeted attacks. Yes, it is, you know, much more heavily monitored. The framework's been, you know, significantly hardened, which is fantastic. And you can see what's happening, you know, through logging. So attackers are preferring other methods, but it's still being used.
No, hang on. Usually the friction point, right, for selling whitelisting has always been about it being a prick to manage, right? Like straight up, that's what people say. It's a pain in the ass.
Yep.
Because ultimately, you know, you've got someone who's making decisions. Like, is that still the friction point, do you think? Or do you think the pain point of getting hosed by ransomware has sort of tilted the scale that, you know, whitelisting binaries is now seen as a bit of a lesser, you know, it's sort of seen as worth the time?
Yeah, definitely the pain's out there. And I think a lot of people are also getting to the point where they've gone through so many different security projects and maturity uplifts over the years, and they might still be feeling that pain, that they're now getting to a point where application whitelisting's like, okay, we've been maybe putting that off for a few years because of the perception that it's too hard. So, you know, we'll get to implementing it now. And I think there's a few things that people make mistakes on when they start to approach an application whitelisting project. And one thing is that it's not really about applications at all. It's about files and binaries and scripts. So you fundamentally need a way of capturing all those binaries and scripts and at scale in order to make sense of them. And a lot of people will just jump in headfirst. They'll you know, use an app locker or another technology, and they'll just start turning on rules, and they'll start to get a huge amount of exceptions, but they don't really have a way to actually make sense of and manage that. And also one thing that we found really interesting out there is that the right people in the organizations, inside organizations, typically aren't managing the application whitelisting implementation. So application whitelisting is best managed by software deployment people, not your security team.
No, it would be the desktop team, right? Like straight up.
Yeah, exactly. But so many organizations say, security team, this is your project, go run with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, they have really good technical insight, the skills in order to...
But they've also got too much other shit to do, right? Whereas the desktop people, the desktop people are going to be all over it, because it's like, you know, that is a pretty powerful thing to have if you're managing desktops.
Exactly right. They know what software's out there, and they know when deployments are going out, and they know, you know, when changes are coming through.
And they know also the pain points for the organization when something breaks, right? So they're gonna just have a more finely tuned radar for what to do. Now, look, you know, I consider Airlock to be like a really, you know, great example of an Aussie success story, because you've only been around for a very short time. Business really kicked up for you. I think it was about a year and a half ago. That's when things really started taking off, and now you're having trouble keeping up, right? Like growth is just insane. Is a lot of this outside of Australia, or is your business sort of confined mostly to within Australia?
Yeah, a significant amount is also outside of Australia as well, particularly in North America. We're getting a lot of interest there, where people, you know, may have tried other application whitelisting solutions with varying results, and now they're basically looking out further. And it's very interesting when they come across it and realize we're an Australian company, you know, just as we're sort of not used to that. It's a nice point of differentiation for us, I guess. But we're just seeing demand across the world. I mean, at the end of the day, everyone's running the same computing systems, and they're experiencing
until China flips on their, you know, their extra special Linux, and the balkanization is happening. But yes, I'm sure you will have plenty of opportunities in Five Eyes markets for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. But look, thank you for joining us. Thanks for sponsoring as well. It's great. Australian company sponsoring another Australian company.
Yep.
It's great to have you on to talk through all of this. Anyone who's interested can check you out at airlockdigital.com. Go get a POC, check it out, because you know, life is too short to run overly bloated endpoint security solutions. Dave Cottingham, it's always great, mate. Thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on your success so far, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Patrick. Cheers.
That was Dave Cottingham there with a chat about whitelisting, host hardening, code audits, and other stuff too. You can find them at airlockdigital.com. Big thanks to Airlock Digital for sponsoring this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with a Soapbox edition. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.